My name is Jean Balance, and I'll be helping to moderate today's Clean Internet Seminar as a part of EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division. Today's seminar, which has been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, is entitled NARPM Presents, a redux of NARPM 2011 Greener Cleanup Sessions, which will look specifically at Greener Cleanup's case studies. We're going to get started in a few moments, but before I kick things off, we're going to wait just another minute for some other individuals to join us. And in the meantime, I'll cover some basic housekeeping items before we get started. So again, everybody should have a copy of the presentation materials open in front of them today before we begin. If you haven't done that, when you registered for today's seminar, you would have been directed to a seminar homepage, which contained a description of today's events, a listing for our presenters and their contact info, and also had links to either download the slides as PowerPoint or PDF, or you could have pulled them up on a web browser window by clicking on the link on the left that says Go to Seminar. So hopefully you guys have either pulled them up or followed one of the email reminders you would have received, and everyone has a copy of the slides open. I'm going to ask everyone to move along from the title slide on slide number 1 to slide number 2, our housekeeping slide. And if you haven't guessed it, for all Clean seminars, each individual participant will be asked to manually advance through the materials at verbal cues from our speakers. So again, I'm on slide number 2, covering housekeeping items.
Hey, Gina, it's Hillary Thornton. I want to let you know that I'm here and on the line with you.
Welcome. Thank you so much, Hillary. Perfect timing. Excellent. Okay, great. So now we have officially checked in with everybody, and we are ready to go. So I will just go through these final reminders, and then I'll turn things over to Hillary out in Region 3. So leading off with the housekeeping items on slide number 2, for those of you on the phone lines, we would ask that you keep your phone lines muted. You can use your own mute button or simply hit star 6 to mute your line. There's no entry or exit tone, so if you have to disconnect, you're welcome to hang up and dial back in at any point, but we would ask that you don't put the call on hold. There can be background music or commercials that may play. So just keep your phone line muted until we get to the point for Q&A, at which time you can take yourself off of mute to ask questions. I'll remind you how to do so when we get to the Q&A breaks, but until then, please remain muted. Again, to either your own mute button or hitting star 6 to mute your line. Again, I'm on slide number 2. We would remind you that if you're streaming the audio online, you won't necessarily be asking questions out loud, but you'll have the opportunity to type up your questions electronically. So if we're looking at the slides in the web browser window, you'll see a series of icons that are located along the top of the slides in orange buttons. The arrows pointing to the single arrow to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. You can also use the numbered links that appear on the left to jump from slide to slide. Again, I'm on slide number 2, the housekeeping slide. As long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, if you click the orange icon with a question mark on it, a new window will open up where you can type up your electronic comment or question. When we get to the break for Q&A, I will read those questions out loud on your behalf to our presenters so they can answer them. You are actually encouraged to submit electronic questions at any time. You don't have to wait to the break to do that. And in fact, it's actually better if you can type them up as soon as they occur to you so that we can get all the questions in the queue and kind of go through them in an orderly fashion when we take breaks for Q&A. As I mentioned, our individual presenters will be indicating as they move through the materials. So if you're just joining us, I'm on slide number 2. You'll have to manually move through those materials. Today's session is being recorded, and you will automatically receive an email from me with the link to download and replay the archive as soon as it's available. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks, so I would encourage you to feel free to forward that link on if you think it was useful. If you want to browse the over 420-something events we have archived on Clean, you're welcome to follow the link on the bottom of slide number 2 to our archive page on Clean. You can also find us if you're a podcast individual person. You go to iTunes, you can search for Clean and find our free podcast there. So, I believe that those are the ends for the official reminders for today's session. One other thing, before we close things out, I will provide links to both a resource page where you can download today's slides as well as other content related to our presentation today, and I'll also provide a link to our short feedback form. So if you're looking to get credit for verification of your participation, you'll want to hang on till the very end and we can provide more information on that. So, with that, I'm going to turn things over and officially begin our presentation. So I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number 3, and I'm going to turn things over to our other moderator today, who's Hillary Thornton from EPA Region 3. Hillary, are you ready?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Jean. And I'm going to go ahead on slide 3. You can see that our first speaker for this Greener Cleanups session, case study session, is the Savannah River Site case study. It's going to be presented by Rachel McCullough, and she is a remedial project manager with the Environmental Protection Agency's Region 4 office in Atlanta. I will soon be joining her there. I'm in Region 3 this week and for a couple more weeks, but I'm soon to move to Atlanta. Rachel there in Region 4 provides technical and regulatory oversight to Superfund projects. She joined the EPA in 2010 as a federal facility project manager and managed remedial projects at the Department of Energy's Savannah River site. Prior to joining EPA, Rachel was a Department of Energy remedial project manager at the Idaho National Laboratory for over 6 years. She has a Master of Science in Waste Management and Environmental Science from Idaho State University and a Bachelor of Science from Norfolk State University. Since joining EPA in 2010, she has also been active in community engagement, environmental justice issues, green remediation, and cleanup at privately owned sites. Rachel, take it away.
Thank you so much, Hillary. Thanks so much for that great introduction, and we are so excited and looking forward to you joining us here in Region 4. So we are excited and can't wait to bring you on board and work with you again. So, again, I'm Rachel McCullough, and I'll be talking a little bit about the greener cleanups at the Savannah River site. As Hillary mentioned in the introduction, I was formerly a Department of Energy RCM working on Superfund projects in Idaho, and it's my great pleasure that I'm now in Atlanta working, at the DOE RCM for EPA here, and I've moved on to private sites, but I definitely earn my bread and butter in federal facilities here. So let's progress on to slide number 4. And I'm sure most of you already know about greener remediation and the definition thereof. We defined green remediation as the practice of considering all environmental aspects of remedy implementation and incorporating those options to minimize environmental footprint of cleanup actions. Now, environmental footprints include the impact on water, materials, energy, and land use, and waste generated during the remediation process. By greening the remediation, we intend to reduce the demand placed on those items during the cleanup action and conserve natural resources. Slide 5. Federal facility sites, EPA is not the lead agency. We are in partnership with the other agencies, the other federal facility. They have been delegated to be the lead agency. And so it's critical as an EPA RPM that we use some other skills in order to get what we need during green remediation. I think the first thing that we're going to talk about is communicating early, clearly, and often what our needs and expectations are by greening the cleanup. And what does a win-win look like? A lot of times, we talk about win-win and everyone coming out on top. Of course, we're doing something good for the environment by doing a remediation. And by greening it, we're including the EPA, the responsible parties, perhaps the federal facilities, the contractors, the environment, and the community. So we need to look at all the impacts that would be involved and how everyone can come out with a win-win. On slide 6, we would also need to look at what are the needs of the responsible party, the federal facility that we're working with. At a federal facility, they're probably already measuring something for their own needs. And it's up to the EPA RCM to look at what they're measuring and can you use that information. If you need for them to measure something in order to quantify or qualify how green the remediation is, perhaps they are already collecting that information, and if not, perhaps they will. A lot of times, again, if you communicate what your needs are early in the process, then you can possibly get what you need from their agency. Many times, it's also good to look at the agency's goals. If you're working with the Department of Defense or working with the Department of Energy, you need to look at what their goals are, and if they have a green remediation strategy per se, perhaps it would be helpful for you to get a copy of that and really familiarize with it, yourself with it, so you can see what those directives may be. Also consider the size, mission, and funding of the agency. It could be that that agency is measuring something that you would like to also be aware of, and if they have an agreement with a university or another third party, you may need to coordinate with them in order to collect that information. You have to remember that you do as you're measured, and if the responsible party is being measured, is being incentivized to measure something, that could be a big part of why they're doing what they're doing. And so your needs may not necessarily be a priority, and you have to be a little bit, let's say, innovative in the way that you go about that. Let me also mention that if you would like to me to pause and ask questions, I'm more than happy to take a breather and Hillary can interject with any questions that you'd like to do. Or we can wait for the end. I also have time at the end, hopefully, for you to ask whatever questions you may like. So, as I mentioned, some other division, let's say, within the agency or another third party, could have the information that you're looking to collect to quantify how green the remediation is. On slide 7, it talks about coordinating with the POP's organization to get what you need. A lot of times we're talking with other engineers and scientists within the federal agency organization, and they may not know how much energy or water is being used in the remediation. So you need to work with them, perhaps, if they're unable to do so within their own agency, and find out who manages their green remediation efforts. This could be with their public relations department because they're promoting how green they are. It could be a facilities management because they're quantifying how much energy is being used for that particular effort, pollution prevention. They could also have wording as EPA has developed in their contract language, and you may need to work with their contractors. Or the headquarters agency may be collecting this from across the board and disseminating that in a different way. So at many times at DOE, we had contractors that were collecting this information for us, so it's just a matter of getting the right person to find out where we could get that information that we were looking for across the table. So as I mentioned, these things are measured, and these contractors may be incentivized to measure or reduce greenhouse gases at their company, and they do that to promote how green they are being.
Andrea? I have a question that came in from Arlington, Virginia, and they asked, are there any large or very public PRPs that truly develop solid green remediation strategies that are not just public relations?
Well, it's hard to say how sincere anyone can be, you know, without really being in the organization and things like that. You know, all you can say is that, you know, they're collecting the information and how solid their efforts are really stands to, you know, really depends on who's receiving the information and what lengths they're willing to go to get you additional information. I think that's really a matter of opinion.
Okay, great. But, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. On slide 8, let's talk a little bit about the few technologies that have been developed at Savannah Riverside, SRS. As I mentioned, this is the Department of Energy facility that's located just outside of Aiken, South Carolina. It's about 300 acres on the Savannah River near Augusta, Georgia, which is on the Georgia-South Carolina border. And it was created in the 1950s as part of the nuclear weapons complex. This is a very large, very old facility that does quite a few things. We're going to talk about a few technologies that are currently being utilized at the SRS, and a few that are still in development that have a great amount of potential, we think. In slide 9, let's look at the barrel ball control valve, and that is a really interesting, actually has one at my desk, not that you can see me or my desk, but the barrel ball control valve is a really interesting technology that increases the efficiency of barometric pumping and allows natural flare gas to flow out of an underground well. It's a technology that you would use for soil vapor extraction, that's the use. It also restricts airflow from the surface into the well. Airflow into the well from the surface to dilute it and possibly spread contaminants still present in the subsurface. On slide 10, you have a cutaway of the barrel ball control valve. Essentially, it's a ping-pong ball that helps to prevent atmospheric air from entering the subsurface. When atmospheric pressure is higher than the pressure in the well, the ball is forced down and seals the valve, preventing surface air from entering. when the pressure in the well is greater than the surface pressure, the ball rises on the stream of air and opening the valve and allowing the contaminants to exit into the atmosphere. And you have a little diagram of how that could happen. It significantly increases the effectiveness of barometric pumping by preventing the inflow of air into the venting well, therefore dispersing it. It's an enhancement of a process system and uses more energy to operate. So this is a pretty green technology. On slide 10, we have a little animation of how that works. Here you have a passive solar construction equipment diagram here where the VOCs are in red and the air and water vapor are in blue. High barometric pressure keeps the VOCs within the beta zone and from escaping into the atmosphere. If you continue on to slide 12, slowly so your animation can work. If it's working, I hope it is. Sounds nice. During lower barometric pressure, when the atmospheric pressure is low, the gas and vapors from the soil raise and exit the surface. On slide 13, VOC concentrations are reduced with each barometric cycle. This can be a great polishing technology to use when the majority of the VOCs have been removed, and you have small amounts of residual contaminants that still need to be removed to reach your performance standards for the VOCs in the subsurface. So this is a great technology that's being used on site at 8 operable units at the Savannah Riverside. On slide 13, we have just a quick summary of the barrel benefits. It's simple, it's very low cost, and very easy to install and maintain. Again, we're talking about a ping-pong ball, so not a whole lot of high-tech technology there. And compared to other methods to reduce SCUs from the beta zone, like digging haul and trapping, this technology has a much lower environmental impact than cost. Also, when you consider bioremediation, that also has a greater cost and a lot more destruction of the land. So this is a technology that we are very familiar with at Savannah Riverside, and it's working quite well there. On slide 15, we look at a similar SCE solar extraction technology that uses a little bit more energy to operate. The microblower is a low-flow, low-power, active soil vapor extraction device that's connected to the wellhead to remove contaminated soil gas. Microblowers can be operated either by power provided directly by solar power or solar recharge batteries. And it can also be used for long-term cleanup and powered by battery, solar, or wind power. On slide 16, we have used microblowers in combination with the barrel bag in a hybrid system where during the daylight hours, the microblower will operate to remove the soil gas. In the afternoon and evening, when solar power wasn't available, barometric pumping would remove contaminated soil gas using the barrel bag. So much like the barrel bag technology, the microblower can be used in the polishing phase of a SCE remediation. And as the slide says, we've removed 234 pounds of VOCs in 10 months. So quite effective there. Another technology being used at the Savannah Riverside is solar powered remote monitoring. The solar energy can be used to power a remote monitoring system, an RMS, for monitoring natural accumulation remediation. And that's being used at 2 groundwater wells, and it could be expanded since I put this together a little while ago. So the RMS consists of wireless data collection, analysis, transmission, and data management, and is intended to remotely detect halogenated VOC levels in contaminated groundwater.
Oh, we actually had another question that came in online. And this question's coming in from South Carolina, and they ask, have you had any issues in the field with the balls in the barrel ball, with the ball sticking or malfunctioning?
No, not that I've heard, and that might be a good question for one of our DOE team kind of parts, but we haven't had any issues with that, with it sticking. It doesn't expand very much, and I know it's seen in South Carolina, my goodness, but We haven't had any reasons to believe that the ball has been sticking.
Okay, great. Thank you.
There are also opportunities to reduce environmental footprint and sampling and analysis. Plastic samplers, sometimes referred to as diffusion samplers, consist of steel polyethylene bags filled with DI water. The bags are suspended directly in a well screen for a period of about 14 days. During this time, the bag is exposed to the natural groundwater flow through the screen zone. Representative amounts of TPE and PPE have been demonstrated to diffuse from the groundwater into the DI water in the bag. And the DI water can be sampled and analyzed using conventional methods. So it's a much more classic way of taking a sample than pumping. So no pumping of groundwater is required, and sampling labor costs and purge water disposal costs are significantly reduced. Fiber optic chemical sensors provide real-time capabilities for stream monitoring and downwell groundwater and waste processing as well. Fiber optic chemical sensor technology detects carbon tetrachloride at parts per million levels and TCE at parts per billion. This is a really sensitive technology. Again, we're looking at reducing or eliminating investigation derived waste, reducing the lab waste stream, and reducing transportation costs. On slide 19, we have a picture of our rapid hydrophobic sampling device, also called SWOOP, that provides detailed delineation of beam apples. If used to optimize location of drilling, SWOOP can reduce environmental impact, greenhouse gases, and IDW. The fleet flexible membrane has been used at SLS to determine a vertical profile of an apple in the subsurface. This technology is reusable, quick, in situ, inexpensive, and reduces the need for drilling and soil collection. And it can also be used in small diameter CPT holes.
Before you move on, I was just double checking if you might be able to move a little bit closer to your speaker or your phone. We've got a comment that you're coming through a little bit distorted, and I don't know if you've moved anything around since you started.
I haven't, but I'm on speakerphone on my cell, and this might help, and let me know if it makes sense.
I think that did the trick right there. Thank you.
Oh, okay, no problem. Thanks for letting me know. Okay. On slide 20, we'll talk about some emerging green remediation tools that are being developed, and who knows, they could be being used right now and on test sites. But we are really excited about these because, again, these are some issues that I think have some technologies that have great potential at Savannah River site and potentially at your sites as well. We're looking at installing bamboo for maintaining caps and covers. Some of you in some areas may have issues with caps because if you don't plant something down there, then like in beautiful South Carolina, you'll get pines and other types of agriculture that will grow, that will destroy the integrity of your cap. Bamboo has shallow roots and are needed to grow up to crowd out the pines and prevent erosion and limit infiltration. SRS is also exploring a groundwater treatment technique that employs agricultural oils to stimulate endogenous microbes, which accelerates the cleanup as well. So they're looking at also using agricultural oils right now and testing those in a wide variety of those to look at potentially being a source of a food source for microorganisms. This technology can be used to treat wastewater, seepage, surface water, and or groundwater contaminated with sulfates, nitrates and nitrites, perchlorate, redox-sensitive materials, and chlorinated solvents. On slide 21, just in summary, I just wanted to touch upon the green remediation at federal facilities can be a win for everyone involved. Again, it's going to take a little bit more communication and coordination and consideration of the needs of the responsible party. We're all feds and working together. But it can also be a great asset for engaging the community. You're doing something great by cleaning up the environment, but they also like to know that you're doing it in a green fashion. It can also be great for your bottom line because it can be cost effective, especially when you consider long-term O&M costs and oversight. So with that, I'll take any questions anyone might have.
Okay, great. Thank you. If you're on the phone lines, you're welcome to take yourself off of mute by either using your own mute button or hitting #6 to unmute your line. You can feel free to either identify yourself or organization and ask your question. Okay, I don't hear anybody on the phone lines, and I don't see any more questions in the online queue, though we already kind of got through a couple of them for you. Was there somebody on the phone lines? Okay, well then with that, I guess we can move right along.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Rachel, for the presentation, and thanks to those folks who asked those questions. I know the one about whether the barrel ball would stick was one that I was going to ask, but I'm glad that somebody else asked it and you answered it. Thank you. Again, we appreciate the Engineering Forum and NARPM. Appreciate your willingness to come and present this first at NARPM and now again for our Internet webinar audience.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Our next speaker is going to be Andrea Benner. If you advance your slides to number 23, you'll see her name. Andrea is an environmental scientist with the U.S. EPA in Region 9 in San Francisco. She has over 30 years of experience with EPA, working both in EPA's headquarters office in Washington, D.C., as well as the regional office. Her primary responsibility has been as a remedial project manager overseeing the cleanup of Superfund sites in Arizona and California. In 1989 through 1993, she worked for the State of Hawaii Department of Health, drafting the state's Superfund law, and worked for the Hawaii Department of Agriculture on developing a program to protect endangered species from exposure to pesticides. She has a Master of Science from the University of San Francisco in Environmental Management, and in 2008 received an MS degree in Sustainability from the School of Engineering at the Blekinge Institute of Technology in Karlskrona, Sweden. Most recently, she has been working on EPA's Repower America program to encourage landowners of contaminated or damaged sites to consider renewable energy for future use of their property. Andrea Benner, welcome and thank you for presenting.
Thank you, Hillary. If everyone would advance to slide 24, I just wanted to give you a slight overview of what I'm going to walk through. I'm focusing on the Apache Powder Superfund site, and I'm going to give you an overview of their history and some of the green remedies that have been implemented at the site. And then the bulk of my discussion will be on a renewable energy evaluation that was conducted by an EPA contractor at the site, and then looking at the potential for solar energy at the site for future use, for portions of the acreage at the facility. Slide 25 gives you a visual of the location of this Apache Powder site. It's southeast Arizona, southeast of both Phoenix and Tucson. It's in a very rural, dry, arid desert landscape. The facility itself is 1,100 acres, totaling about 9 square miles. The outline in red shows you the facility boundaries. The next slide, 26, gives you an old historical photograph showing you the landscape itself, sort of the desert badlands topography. The facility began manufacturing explosives in the 1920s. They currently are still an operating facility, primarily manufacturing ammonium nitrate and nitrogen fertilizers. The facility was identified for the National Priorities List, the Superfund National Priorities List, in 1990, and if it were discovered today in 2012, it most likely would have been managed under the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, RCRA, because it is still an active operating manufacturing facility, which is unusual. I think you would be hard-pressed to find that many other Superfund sites that are still operating. Slide, the next slide, slide 27, shows you the facility from a current perspective, looking across a wide open space that once was evaporation ponds that took washdown waters, and part of the soils cleanup remedy at the site was capping this area, and that led also to this recently graded, rather flat terrain that looked optimum for siting potential solar panels or looking at a solar option for the facility. So of the two media components that needed remedy, the soils area was one, and then slide 28 shows you a constructed wetland system that was constructed to deal with the nitrate-contaminated groundwater. And this was extremely unique at the time it was implemented. It was constructed in 1997 before the linguistics and language had even been developed within EPA for greening sites. The motivation for putting in the wetland system was that of this 1,100 acres, most of the acreage has no electrical, there's no grid, there's no transmission lines, there's no power. And so we began to look at ways to fight the remedy where we didn't have power. But then most importantly, in the case of the wetlands, we realized that we could use a wetland system to denitrify the nitrate, which was passive, low energy consumption. It was totally feasible, or seemed to be feasible from the feasibility studies, although I must say that some of the engineers within EPA were naysayers in the beginning. But as of 2005, when everything had settled down, the vegetation was fully in place, it's been treating 24/7, 365 days a year, down to the maximum contaminant limit, the MCL, for nitrate of 10 ppm. We used solar panels to recirculate the water in the initial startup stages because we weren't yet treating down to the discharge limit, and we were doing some holding and retention and recycling of water. So the lower photograph on slide 28 shows you those panels that, and that was an initial introduction, I think, of solar at the site. So now I'm going to sort of focus more on the renewable energy process itself, and how the main components of that process were looking at the renewable energy potential itself, how much suitable acreage was available for solar access that was sited well for solar, then what technologies might be feasible at the site, and then the economics of it. So if you move to slide 30, before that process started, one great catalyst for this was I had just been in Sweden. When I returned, a young intern had just arrived at EPA from the private sector, from the venture capital sector, Silicon Valley, I think. And basically, she came in, Sarvi Madhavi, and said, we really need to package up what the renewable energy market is and what it's all about and what the incentives are at the federal and state level for implementing renewable energy, because we won't be able to sell it, basically. And so she came up with this idea of coming up with a 10 to 15 page brochure, basically, similar to an EPA fact sheet that would outline the overview of the industry as well as the specific incentives for the state of Arizona, and then drilling down a little further into actual the state's renewable energy solar potential at that time. So this brochure, if you move to slide 30 and 31, just gives you some sense of what we packaged up in that, and that was used by the company management, the environmental manager initially, and then the CEO, to then go to the board of directors to talk about the potential for the site. Slide 32 is the first slide that starts to give you some sense of the components of the actual evaluation, which was done by an EPA headquarters contractor to look at what was feasible here. Again, the first step was just looking at the topography on slide 32. If you go to slide 33, we then looked at the energy context for the facility itself. So we knew that solar had a lot of applications for some small parts of the remedy, which I'll discuss later in this discussion. But the first step and the most critical step, I think, if you have a Superfund site, a brownfield site, an old mine site, any industrial site that has even something like the General Motors manufacturing facilities, that type of major industrial setting, you want to look at where you have substations, the transmission capacity, who the local utility is, if they're willing and interested in having more energy generated at your particular site location. So that type of analysis was initially done at Apache. What was the transmission capacity, as well as what was their on-site electrical use? And this is a major manufacturing facility. They use, worst case, 2 megawatt a day. Their electrical bill runs over, well, their power bill runs over $1 million a year. So anything that could offset that for future use for the company itself looked advantageous. If you move to slide 34, we basically were looking at, could they use power on site for some of the buffer land, the extra additional acreage above and beyond the footprint of the actual manufacturing facility, and or could it be sold back to the grid via the local utility, the cooperative that existed there? They also need steam for their manufacturing, and certain technologies are very suitable for steam generation. So slide 35, though, shows you the first initial step after looking at the actual transmission electrical component of making a project happen. We looked at how much of the available acreage had a slope of less than 5%. And the beige areas identify the unsuitable areas where there are either arroyos or washes or manufacturing already occurring in that area. And the green was the first cut at where we might have large flat contiguous areas that would be suitable. Slide 36, kind of in a matrix format, shows if you have 25 acres or 40 acres, what are the minimum acreage requirements for concentrating solar power, CSP versus photovoltaic, and just trying to mix and match what was available with what the technology could offer. The next slide, 37, looks at the acreage in a more in-depth point of view. If you look at these different 70 acres, the turquoise area marked A at the bottom of the screen on the map, that was the area where the evaporation ponds had been capped. That looked like the most optimum area for siting something. It would be reasonably close to the manufacturing area, which is in a slightly darker beige above area B. But you can see the mix and match of the acreage and trying to see what might be feasible where. Again, just to preface this, this was not a full-fledged cost analysis FS feasibility study in the terms of what we're used to seeing for a Superfund remedy. I would say this was the equivalent of a pre-feasibility study, but still reasonably in-depth to screen in or out whether this site was suitable for renewable energy generation. Slides 38 and 39 are giving you 38, just if you aren't familiar with these technologies, concentrating solar is a trough mirrored technology. It's more efficient, or historically it's been more efficient than photovoltaic, but it has a high water demand, and actually in the arid Southwest, we're pretty much EPA, not exactly screening it out, but photovoltaic pricing has really dropped. It's become much more cost effective over even since 2008, now by 2011, 2012. Slide 39 just gives you an overview of PV just as comparison, and this was where we were moving much more towards photovoltaic. Slide 40 shows drilling down a little deeper, thin film versus crystalline silicone versus PV tracking. If you look at the acreage again, you're going to need 40 to 50 acres for the tracking versus maybe 20, 25 with fixed. Costs are very, very high for any of this. You're looking at $30 million to $45, $50 million for a 5-megawatt facility. So that's a major investment, and you need help. It's not viable for most companies just to do this completely independently without all the incentives that are out there. If you look at slide 41, this was just another example of the type of analysis we did in this sort of pre-feasibility screening, looking at what if they developed a 3-megawatt array versus a 5-megawatt array. Again, this was looking at PV and then looking at the company's own peak demand for their electrical needs. Slide 42 gives you kind of the pros and cons, the limitations and benefits. Some of these pros and cons were packaged up again for the company to use internally when they briefed their management on just why they should even think about considering this. The public relations question that came up earlier and with Rachel's discussion, I mean, obviously when you're trying to encourage a company to do this, that is one element that is presented as a pro for the company. But in this case, we were looking at, again, concentrating solar power versus PV, that the CSP could generate the steam that the company needed. But again, on the con side or the limitation, the arid Southwest and the limitations, concentrating solar power really not being the optimum choice. If you look at slide 43, I'm not going to go into these different credit programs, but these incentives and renewable energy credits and the renewable energy portfolio standard of a particular state is a key component of whether a project like this might work on any site that you might be managing. The incentives are very high in places like New Jersey, which might be a complete surprise, as well as California. Other states are, Colorado has been quite proactive. If you look at slide 44, it gives you an overview in 2008-2009. What's quite fascinating, in 2009, New Jersey had more installed photovoltaic deployment of PV in New Jersey than California, which I think no one would have ever expected. And New Jersey continues to be a leader nationally because they have very aggressive state renewable energy portfolio standards. They're very supportive of the industry. California, as kind of a given, people pretty aware of California's. But if you look at Arizona, Hawaii, there's New York. You would never expect, again, New York to be right up there in some of the top states deploying solar. And one thing to keep in mind, you might be saying to yourself as you're listening to this, oh, I'm in North Dakota or I'm somewhere else, and there's either no solar, well, there may be wind in the Midwest, and you may be thinking, oh, it's always cloudy, but New Jersey, evidently half the days of the year are cloud covered in New Jersey. Germany is also very cloud covered, and 27% of the world's solar is now in Germany. So just because you're in an environment that you intuitively think may not be suitable, it actually may be suitable. So Moving to slide 45, I just wanted to kind of summarize, again, picking up on some of the points Rachel made at this site. We did similar things. We used solar-powered flow meters for the wetlands, solar-powered security gate, power for the security gate at the facility. Just as a reminder, the company now manufactures ammonium nitrate, so it's a high level security facility in terms of heating totally gated and fenced. And then we also use solar panels to for pumping groundwater, well, really perched groundwater, where the old evaporation ponds were located. There was a fair amount of water that was sitting on top of clay in the subsurface that needed to be extracted, and that's still ongoing, using solar-powered pumps to extract the groundwater. Moving on to slide 46, probably one of the most interesting things that happened in 2010 was they put a solar canopy over their administrative buildings, and they are saving themselves about $6,000 a year on their electrical and cooling bills. The payback was just 6 years on this for the capital investment cost, and they hardly paid anything for it. They were able, through federal and state tax credits and utility incentives, to basically offset their costs. Slide 47.
Stop you before you go any further. This is just a reminder. If you're on the phone lines, we would ask that you mute your phone. Again, we can hear people moving some stuff around and some side conversations, so please, please, please mute your phone. Check that mute button or hit *6 to mute your line. And I may have to globally mute if I don't hear the background noise stop. So again, it's *6 to mute your phone line. Okay, I'm sorry, Andrew, please go ahead.
So slide 47 is a visual of this canopy, and one of the great features of this is it also incorporated water harvesting. There is a large gutter system, and again in Arizona, how much rain is there, but they do have torrential monsoon rains at different times of the year. So they have underground water cisterns where these gutters transport the water into these cisterns. And then in the upper right photo, there's a xeriscape, desert landscape that they installed in front of their administrative building. And this was right after it was constructed, but now it's quite flourishing with cacti blossoming in the spring, and they use the underground cisterns to irrigate it when needed. Slide 48 gives you the big, big long-term picture if solar a 5-megawatt facility were ever deployed at the site. This was the type of technology they were looking at, a 2-axis system. It's a very large footprint. It needs 5 acres per megawatt, so they'd need at a minimum 25 acres. And I pointed out that 70-acre area at the turquoise area A area on that one earlier would probably be where it would be sited. Currently, with a couple of factors, including the economic environment, this is totally, you know, in the study stage. It's been packaged up. It's not moving forward at the moment, but it's sitting on the shelf, so to speak, if it were determined to be viable in the future. At the moment, the company recently went through a complete management change. It went through a change of ownership and management, so the new group is all getting settled in. In closing, lessons learned. Solar energy development is compatible with Superfund sites, with RCRA sites, brownfields, old mine sites, old industrial sites. So wherever you're coming into this conversation, think about it. Wherever you have large acreage and you have transmission, I would say it's extremely important to know from the very, very, the first 10 days when you're looking at this, try to sort out how far away the nearest transmission line is. If it's 3-5 miles away even or more, then really stop and take a deep breath, because just the cost of and getting in a queue with a utility to get transmission lines is a very long process. But if you already are an industrial site with a substation, with nearby lines, it's often just low-hanging fruit from the point of a utility if suddenly that you come to them with a proposal because they're interested in generation two wherever they can get it easily. Again, another lesson learned is this issue of cost. I mean, it is still very, very expensive. For 5 megawatts, you're talking $25 million. Now it might be a little less, but because costs keep going down, but it's still in a mega project scale. And then a power purchase agreement through the utility is absolutely essential to make a project go. So again, that conversation is very important. And then moving to slide 50, public-private partnering, working with whether it's Department of Energy, Department of Defense, EPA, wherever you can leverage partnerships and leverage grant potential through partnering with other agencies. EPA has quite a several multi-year history with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory under DOE, working on our Repower America program on mapping efforts as well as grant efforts. If you're a Superfund site, you might be able to also get brownfields money through their targeted brownfields assessments. So wherever you can leverage other resources for your project, try to do that as much as possible. So in closing, even a utility-scale renewable energy project may be feasible at Superfund sites, which is probably something we never would have even thought about 5 years ago. So with that, if there are any questions, thank you for your interest.
Okay, great. We do have a number of questions that have been submitted electronically. But before I turn to those, let's start with the people who have joined us by phone. So if you're on the telephone and you have a question for Andrea, please feel free to take yourself off of mute. It's only for the question part, and then I'd ask you to remute your line. So you can use your own mute button or simply hit #6 to unmute, and feel free to identify yourself and organization and ask your question. Okay, so I'm going to start with the individuals who have submitted questions electronically, and then we'll check back to see if anybody else on the phone. This first question, I think you've sort of touched on it, but they had a couple of other specific questions that might be interesting in relation to just green remediation in general. They first asked if you sell the energy back to the local grid, and then what happens to the money from that sale? Would that money go back to the PRP or to the federal government?
So in the case of Apache Powder, it would go back to the PRP if they chose to develop it. If they personally, as a company, chose to develop it, in reality, that company, most companies don't have the $25 or $30 million to do the development themselves. So there would be partnerships with a developer, with utilities, it may end up that Apache would just lease the land. In fact, that was the direction they were going when this idea is basically on the shelf at the moment. But the prior management was looking at, it's an ammonium nitrate facility. It has immense amount of acreage. It needs buffer land. And therefore, they could lease this to a developer. And developers were really looking for this type of situation where the transmission lines were already in and the substations were there. And there were already plans in the queue to upgrade those lines. So the bottom line, though, would be if there was any revenue stream, it would go back, in this case, to the PRP. This is a very, very odd situation in that, as I said, it's a very unusual site for a Superfund site, but I guess the parallel would be a RCRA facility. If you have a RCRA facility that's still actively operating, we don't have a mechanism. There isn't a mechanism where we would, say, require the money to come back to EPA. We settle our costs with the company through a separate enforcement process. I don't know if that's Do you think that's...
No, I think that's more than sufficient.
Okay.
Our next one is coming in from Bellevue, Washington, and this is in reference to slide number 40. They'd like to know if the numbers on slide 40 and the estimates are just the... Pardon me, let me read this exactly as they stated it. Are the numbers and estimates just rule of the thumb industry averages, or were they site-specific to the Apache site?
At the time, they were rule of thumb averages at that time in 2009-2010. So they were not site-specific to Apache. They were site-specific to the type of... On slide 40, the PV numbers were the numbers at that time. And this was completed, I think the study started in 2009, was completed in 2010.
Okay, great. The next question also comes in from Bellevue, Washington, and this is in reference to slide number 44. They ask, are there numbers aggregated for 2010, and what explains the really high jump over tenfold for New Jersey from 2008 to 2009?
These numbers were pulled, I think, from a Department of Energy perspective at the time, from 2009. New Jersey jumped immensely again. I went on the web because I knew this was out of date as we were presenting it. This was presented a year ago and at that time it wasn't quite as out of date, and I was looking to see if it could be updated for the presentation today. And interestingly, New Jersey has jumped again. New Jersey, again, I think because they have such aggressive renewable energy portfolio standard that it was going from 255, this said the doubled solar between 2010 and 2011 from 255 to 550 megawatt. And that was a projection from 2011. So I'm amazed at New Jersey myself. So I think all these tables could be updated, but these were the numbers at that point in time.
Okay, great. And our next question online, also coming in from Washington, asks, what kind of geotech and engineering considerations need to be taken into account when doing the HCPV?
Well, we started moving towards looking at photovoltaic instead of the high concentrating. Oh, I'm sorry. The high concentrating photovoltaic was the question. The HCPV.
Yeah, that's correct.
We were, at the time, I would say, looking at this study at the macro level. I personally did not do the study. The study was done by an EPA contractor, SCAO, out of Charlottesville, Virginia. And I think in terms of, I pointed out on slide, I think it's slide 48, just some of the issues related to you need the larger footprint, but we were looking at efficiency, and it seemed more and more that people were looking to the high concentrated, are still looking at the high concentration photovoltaic as being advantageous over the older technologies. It's just the technologies are moving and evolving very quickly. The prices are dropping, and they're becoming more and more efficient. Certain technologies developed by NASA are now coming into the marketplace through various developers. But I can't add much more than what I just said, in that I'm not a solar expert.
Okay, great. Thank you. And just real quickly, anybody else on the phone lines have a final question or comment? Okay. Well, thank you so much, Andrea. I think we can go ahead and move along. And Hillary, if you're ready, we can resume. I think we're going to move on to slide number 52.
Sure, slide 52. I'll give a little introduction to Kira Lynch, our final speaker for today. Kira is an environmental scientist with over 20 years' experience in environmental characterization and remediation.
She is currently the EPA Office of Research and Development Science and Technology Liaison in Region 10, the Seattle office, and she's providing technical support on responsible party, federal facility, and Superfund lead projects. She has expertise in the characterization and cleanup of groundwater DNAPL sites. Those are dense, non-aqueous phase liquids. She is a member of the EPA Engineering Forum. Prior to working for EPA Region 10, she served as one of the Army Corps Innovative Technology Associates, or ITAs, for 10 years, and worked in the Quality Assurance Management Section for EPA Region 9. She has been involved in the design and evaluation of several Department of Defense Environmental Security Technology Certification Program, ESTCP, research projects, and has served as an advisory committee member for the University of Washington Superfund Research Program grant. Kira has been involved in the development of numerous EPA and U.S. Army Corps guidance documents on environmental remediation and characterization. She has also been the author on several journal articles on cleanup approaches for DNAPL sites and the use of adaptive site management, also known as the triad approach, to site characterization and cleanup. Kira has a Bachelor's of Science in Environmental Toxicology from the University of California, Davis, and a Master of Science in Environmental Management from the University of San Francisco. Thank you, Kira, for speaking with us today.
Thanks, Hillary. So if we can go on to slide number 53. I'm going to talk about a case study today that's at a little bit different place in the pipeline than the other studies that we've been talking about. And this is a Superfund lead cleanup site in the state of Washington. It is a site that had a pump and treat system in place from a rod that was signed in the late 80s, and we looked at the site back in 2009 and did a rod amendment because it became clear that the site still had a DNAPL source area that needed some action taken at the site. So this is a site where we did do a rod amendment. The rod amendment specified a 3-technology approach to source strength reduction. It included doing excavation of some of the source area, followed by in-situ thermal heating with electric resistive heating, and then finally doing some enhanced bioremediation in some of the areas of the higher concentration groundwater plume. One of the things that is unique about this site, which is similar to many other sites where we're doing source treatment, is that the ROD amendment specified that we were going to use these 3 technologies in a treatment train type approach, but it left open the flexibility to be able to optimize how we combined those 3 technologies to actually do the source treatment, which also opened up the door to allow us to look at how do we combine these technologies and optimize them from all different aspects, including how can we utilize these 3 technologies in the way that makes the most sense from an energy use standpoint and from a green remediation standpoint. So with that in mind, when we did the ROD amendment, we did include in the ROD amendment, in the section that talks about protection of human health and the environment, that in going forward with the remedial design for the site, consistent with the remedial action objectives, that we would look for opportunities to implement optimization efforts that would reduce the environmental footprint of the action itself. So I think what's important here is that many people, when we're talking about EPA's initiatives in regards to promoting green remediation, they want to jump to the idea that what EPA is promoting is to select one technology over another because there's some perceived benefits from the standpoint of saying that one technology is more environmentally friendly than the other, and that's really not the direction that our policy is going. What we are really looking at is selecting technologies or approaches that meets the Superfund criteria to be protective of human health and the environment, and then looking for opportunities in the way that we design that remedy or that we implement that remedy to make it more environmentally friendly. So it's not a matter of changing the RAOs, but rather more from the standpoint of engineering optimization of what we've selected to do. So going on to slide number 54, on this site, one of the things that we did going into the remedial design directly after completing the feasibility study is we evaluated the site from the standpoint of looking at the environmental footprint through the methodology that was developed by EPA for its footprint methodology. And the main goal of that is to go through and look at your approach and identify those components that are the largest contributors to the environmental footprint. And once you've done that, you can look at opportunities or potential ways to reduce the footprint associated with those components of the design. So going on to slide number 55, this is an example of the matrix that came out of the evaluation that was done for the Well 12A Time Oil site. And you can see across the top we have the major components of the actual source treatment that were included. So we have excavation in the first column. We have in-situ thermal remediation in the second column. We have enhanced bioremediation in the third column. And then the fourth column was the footprint associated with the groundwater extraction and treatment system, which was already in place and which the remedy assumed would have to run during the actual source treatment and potentially for some period following the actual source treatment itself. So you can see here one of the things that came out in the footprint analysis is that we did identify that the actual environmental impacts from the excavation were really significant for many of the different factors, much more so than any of the other technologies. And I think this is important to point out because I think intuitively some people would think, well, you know, electrical resistive heating, that's a really intensive energy and it's going to be really environmentally unfriendly. But the reality is that you need to look at all of the trade-offs. So for example, when you're doing in-situ heating, it may be energy intensive for a short period of time, but you get to your goal much more quickly than other technologies. And then in addition to that, in the state of Washington, a large majority of our electrical power is actually supplied by hydroelectric power, which makes the overall environmental footprint of using electrical power less environmentally impactful than other states that may rely on other energy sources for electrical power. So I think it's a really beneficial exercise to go through. EPA has now finalized our methodology. It's available for use by anyone it's available for download through the internet. And I think one of the things that it really does that's helpful for your project team is it really lays out transparently what are the various components of your remedy and where as a team can you be looking at ways to optimize or reduce that environmental footprint. So going on to slide number 56. Following the environmental footprint analysis, one of the things that we did is we looked at design modifications. Since we were looking at doing the excavation for the shallower contamination in the same general vicinity where we were going to be doing the electrical resistive heating, one of the things that we looked at was a trade-off of excavating to a shallower depth and thus reducing the volume of material being excavated and increasing the volume that we were heating with electrical resistive heating. And from that standpoint, it made a lot of sense to be able to do that, not only from a cost perspective, but also from an energy use perspective. So going on to slide number 57, one of the things that we did coming out of the footprint analysis and going into remedial design is we basically changed the depth of excavation for the excavation area from 10 feet within that footprint area to 5 feet. And then we correspondingly decreased the depth where we would start the thermal heating. So as opposed to starting at 10 feet below ground surface, we changed the specification to be from 5 feet to the depth that we were going to treat to. So going on to slide number 58, some of the other outputs of the footprint methodology that were implemented in the actual excavation component of the design is we looked at ways to decrease the footprint associated with the transportation and disposal of the waste material. Some of the things that we included as specifications in our excavation design was a preference for local borough sources and disposal facilities. We also required that the concrete be segregated and recycled locally. We also looked at pre-characterizing the soil, and one of the things that came out in our discussions with the contracting officer that I think is going to be important when we're trying to implement these types of best management practices for making our construction projects greener is that there's a fine line between in a specification telling a contractor, for example, you must use disposal facility X, Y, or Z because it's closer to the site and will have less impact on transportation. We can't do that from a contractual standpoint because we can't specify what disposal facility that contractor has to use. But what we can do is we can specify that we want that contractor to consider when selecting their disposal facility what the footprint would be associated with transport to that facility and to show us and justify the facility that they've selected to document that they've taken that into consideration. So the difference there is this idea that you can't specify the means and methods, but you can get at the same goal by the way that you write your specification. So it's really more focusing on requiring an analysis to determine the greenest transport method. So going on to slide number 59, one of the other factors that we considered was diesel emissions, which is another consideration that will always be something that should be considered, especially on any kind of excavation, a dig and haul type site. So we have specifications that required no idling for all vehicles and equipment. We have some requirements to use cleaner engines and cleaner fuel, as well as requirements that required the contractor to track the emissions and show us how they were going to reduce emissions with their cleaner diesel equipment and fuels. And then finally, going on to slide number 60, one of the components that I was kind of highlighting when we went into this that we talk about when we talk about greening our environmental remediation designs is this whole idea of optimizing where we're applying technologies. And it goes back to the whole idea, if we, for example, are going in and trying to clean up a source area, DNAPL source area, and we have a particular area that we're targeting, it makes sense from a cost and efficiency standpoint, and an optimization standpoint, as well as the standpoint of reducing our environmental footprint, to make sure that the area and volume that we're targeting for that source reduction is the area that really needs to be treated, that we're going to get the biggest bang for our buck for treating that area. So the whole idea is consistent with not only optimizing from an engineering standpoint, but at the same time that you're optimizing from an engineering standpoint on how you're applying a technology, you're also optimizing from the standpoint of reducing the overall environmental footprint associated with implementing that remedial action. So in our case, with the Time Oil site, since we have the flexibility to look at optimizing the combination of these technologies and the conceptual site model as we've gone along, we not only have continued to look at optimizing from an engineering standpoint, but also from the standpoint of taking into consideration all of the factors that we learned in going through the environmental footprint methodology to make sure that those factors were also considered as we've moved forward and optimized the remedial design for the source treatment at the Time Oil site. So that is my last slide for this case study, and I'm going to turn it back over to Hillary.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Hillary, do you want to take a couple of questions for Kara?
Absolutely.
Okay. Those of you on the phone lines, if you have a question, feel free to take yourself off of mute. Remember, it's #6 to unmute. We'd ask you to identify yourself or your organization. Okay, I don't see any questions in the online queue either. So, Hillary, did you want to make any other statements and see if we can hang on for another minute or two before we close things out and get any other questions?
Sure. I'd like to take this opportunity to remind everyone that the footprint methodology is available on cluin.org/green remediation. You can download it from that location. And we just completed on the 18th of April a good webinar on the footprint, environmental footprint methodology, which is available now in the archive. So I encourage you to visit the cluin.org web seminar archives and take a listen to that one if you missed it. It's a good webinar to learn more about that. I also want to thank our three presenters today, Rachel McCullough, Andrea Benner, and Kira Lynch, for taking your time to develop these presentations, to present them at last year's NARPM conference, and to come back on the line with us all today and to represent that material, particularly helpful to folks who are not able to travel to the NARPM conferences but are still interested in these greener cleanup topics. So, thanks. Jean, has anything else come in?
Nope, not yet. So, if there aren't any other comments or questions, I'm going to have everybody go ahead and move along to slide number 61 so we can officially start the closeout process. On slide number 61, you'll see our resources and feedback slide. And there are two important links on slide 61. The first, wait a minute, I spoke too quickly. We do have a question that came in online for Kira. Pardon me, Kira, if you're still with us. This question's coming in from Bellevue, Washington. And they ask, are there any plans to track the environmental footprint as the remediation is implemented?
Yes, actually we are. And tracking, at least we're tracking what the energy use is and what we believe are the reductions that are achieved, and that is part of the cost and performance reporting for each of the components. So that is something that we are going to be doing. We have just completed the excavation piece of this, and we have it for that. And we're moving into the in-situ thermal remediation piece. So it's going to be a couple years before we have all of this all put together, but it is something that we are trying to track.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Kara. I appreciate that. And thank you for slipping in the question before we officially close things out. As a reminder, if there are questions that come up either after today's seminar or later on if you're replaying the archive, the contact information for all of the organizers and presenters can be found on the seminar homepage. And you're certainly welcome to either email or contact myself and check in to pass along a question to one of the presenters if you'd like. You're welcome to do that for any of our seminars, including today's.
Can we take one more from the phone?
Absolutely, we can. Go right ahead, Mike.
Hi, this is Mike Gill, Region 9. And this is going back to Rachel McCullough's talk. Rachel, you had mentioned that as one of the emerging technologies, bamboo is being considered for maintaining caps and covers. I know from personal experience, bamboo grows very fast and doesn't go very deep, but it is very invasive. So can you again review its benefit for maintaining caps and covers? It seems like it would actually breach the cover or the cap, and it's not something I think you would want.
And that, if Rachel, if you're with us on the phone, you may have muted. It's #6 to unmute. Well, if Rachel's not there, do any of the other presenters have any experience using bamboo at a site?
This is Mike. I can email her my question.
Okay.
It just seems like it's not the best choice, but maybe they have some other species of bamboo or something that they're talking about than you see out here in California.
Well, that's a great question, and thank you for following up with Rachel offline. Okay, I don't hear anybody else on the phones, but feel free to interject if it does pop up before I close things out today. So again, I'm going to go ahead with slide number 61, where you'll find two links on our resources and feedback. The first link will bring you to our resources page that was put together for today's seminar. You can also access this link from the seminar homepage. You'll see a button that appears on the left that says links. And if you click on that, it'll bring you to not only an area where you can download the slides, but you can take a look at other websites and resources related to today's presentation. The second link on slide number 61 is a link to our short feedback form. It does take just about a minute or two to fill that out, and please know that I read each and every one of those responses. So if you found today's session informative and you'd like to see future free training offered through CLUIN, please take a moment to fill out that feedback form. We do need your comments to ensure that we can continue to deliver Internet seminars via CLUIN. If you shared the line with multiple participants, once you submit feedback, you can certainly, there'll be a link that'll pop up after you submit a form, and it'll give you the option to allow the next person to hop on the computer and fill out their own feedback form. If you're looking for credit or verification of your participation today, we don't offer CEUs or PDHs through CLUIN, but many of our participants can earn credit through accrediting organizations by supplying a copy of their registration email, a copy of the slides, and a copy of a verification email that you can receive once you submit feedback. So again, you'll have to collect that information and check with your accrediting organization, but if you'd like to get one of those verification emails, if you fill out the feedback form, there's a box you can check, and an email will be sent to you for your own records to at least verify that you did submit feedback for today's session when we concluded things. So I think those are the ends of the official reminders I had before I close things out. I want to extend my thanks to all of our presenters and organizers who put together today's session, as well as those of you who joined us and were able to ask questions and engage with our presenters. On slide 62, I just wanted to let everybody know that there are new ways to stay connected with us on CLUIN. We have recently launched Facebook and Twitter pages, so if you'd like to follow us tweet by tweet, you are welcome to go ahead and follow us or like our page on Facebook. We also just set up a LinkedIn group, so if you can only access the professional networking site LinkedIn while you're at work, you can take a look or search for Cleanup Information Network. There's an open discussion group that you can join on LinkedIn to sort of stay engaged with us. So again, I want to echo my thanks to everyone who made it out for today's seminar. I hope that you found it to be an informative use of your time today. And with that, I will formally conclude today's Kluwen Internet Seminar, and I hope to either hear or see you soon at a future session. Thank you so much.